morning. As usual, there are class papers here, there, and everywhere. There's some back on the chair back there at the back. If anyone comes in that seems to be lost, just direct them to those. If you've got extras and someone needs one, then by all means, share. So, 2 Samuel chapter 3 this morning. I've prepared about 2 hours worth of class, so so we're just going to have the folks stand in the back and wait till we're done. Now, there's so much that you can think about when you in a chapter like we're going to read today that it's hard to know what to settle on. I think something to keep in mind as we read this chapter is that we're going to see behaviors that sometimes in the Bible we read stuff and it's just reported to us, right? Without a lot of editorial comment. And we're like, well, am I supposed to think that this is a good behavior or a bad behavior? Have you ever had that experience as you read the Bible, especially as you're reading history in the Old Testament, a lot of the 1 and 2 Samuel stuff, people do things, and even the good guys, the supposed good guys, do things that we need to recognize from other parts of Scripture are sinful behavior, okay? And even David, the man after God's own heart, the king that we all look to as, you know, the great example of a kingship in Israel, even David makes bad choices, does things that are against God. All right, and we'll talk more about that. But we're going to see that happen pretty much with everybody we encounter in today's story, in today's chapter. So it's just important to keep that in mind. And it's always good to balance what we read in one section of the Bible with what God tells us somewhere else. Okay, that way we can make sure we're understanding, oh yeah, he did that, but that's not really God's will. Okay? All right, let's have a word of prayer. Roger, can you lead us in prayer, please?
Lord, as we begin to look at your word, we pray that you'd open our minds, that the Spirit would enable us to understand the lessons that are contained there, that you'd be with Brian as he directs us. We pray that this period of study and reflection might be a blessing to us, that it would help us as we live our life before you, in Jesus' name.
Amen. All right. We're going to start right in at the beginning of chapter 3. We're going to start by reading the first 5 verses. And that contains a lot of goofy names. So, I don't know if anybody wants to volunteer to try to tackle the goofy names, or, you know. Bob, look, I love that.
I don't know any better, I'll try.
Yeah, yeah. The thing about Bible names is just act like you, just say anything, act like you're confident, and people will believe it. So.
Yeah. Well, that one's good. Say you did it wrong.
Right, yeah. We have no idea, right? So, no one's going to say that they're wrong. So let's go ahead. First 5 verses, 2 Samuel chapter 3.
The war between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. Sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amon, the son of Ahiman of Jezreel. His second, Chilion, the son of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. The third, Absalom, the son of Michal, daughter of Talmud, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonai, the son of Haggai. And the fifth, Shephatai, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Irithium, the son of David's wife, Elga. They were born to David in Hebron.
Okay. Well done, Bob. Well done.
That was perfect.
Yes, it was. Yes, so they enjoyed interesting names in those times, I know. So, the first verse is a summary statement, right? It kind of is the, just a general, hey, a war happened for a long time between the house of Saul, the house of David. David grew stronger and stronger. The house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And, you know, we read a statement like that. Okay, yeah, okay, we get it. There was war for a long time. And it's becoming clear. We knew all along that David was going to win, right? But it's becoming more and more clear that that's everybody, that that's the situation. What do we miss, though, when we read just a general, especially a summary statement like that about war? It's kind of like saying, World War II lasted for, how many years? 6 years? However many years World War II lasted. You make a statement like that, okay, yeah, we had war. What do you miss, though, by just making a general statement, especially about war?
There's no detail.
You don't get any detail. You don't know the battle. You don't know how many people suffered, how many people died. During this long war, that's what's going on, right? People are dying. Families are losing their husbands, right? Their fathers. There's death and destruction happening. There's division happening within the family of Israel.
War takes a toll on everyone.
Yes. Yeah, and this is a war that and we could debate whether it was actually God's will for this war to happen or not. But it seems like, as we started to talk about last week, and we'll see more of this week, I think there's some things that could have happened differently, choices people could have made that maybe would have allowed this not to happen. There might have been a way to resolve it differently. You know, we started a little bit about that last week, and that happens, right? You know, we make choices that sometimes lead to consequences that we, in retrospect, we say, well, if we'd made a different choice, it would have been better. So anyway, a long time war is going on. David's growing stronger and stronger. Saul and his house is growing weaker and weaker. That didn't just start with the death of Saul, though, did it? In reality, way back when Samuel told Saul, God has taken the kingdom from you and will give it to another, that's when this process began of David growing stronger and Saul growing weaker. So it's a long time process. All right, now, the names. Then Bob read all those names. What do you notice? What do those verses tell you about David, about his kingdom, about his family?
Not many wives.
Yeah, that's one son per wife, and what are there, six there? Right? We knew about two of them already from before, right? The first two, Ahinoam and Abigail. We learned about them in 1 Samuel. Those were not his first wife, though. His first wife was?
Saul's daughter.
Saul's daughter, Michal, who we're gonna see in this chapter in a little bit. So we've got a lot of wives. Thoughts?
That's a no-no.
What's that?
That's a no-no.
It's a no-no.
That alone caused a war.
Yes.
It wasn't just in David's kingdom that was widely practiced.
Yes. It was a cultural practice, especially for kings. And you notice at least one of the wives seems to be a political union, right? It's the daughter of a king of another kingdom, right? That probably won't be the first of that sort of thing. It's culturally okay, but in God's eyes, it's not okay. We're not going to go back and find it, but when God was giving the law and he said, there's going to be a point in which you're going to want a king, and your king is not to take for himself multiple wives, is what God instructed the people of Israel. All right? Just because the culture's doing it, doesn't mean that it was the right thing to do. And so there's an example of David not doing the right thing. And when you think about the trouble in David's life that we'll read about later in 2 Samuel, it is a direct correlation with this problem he has of all these wives and all the children that come from it.
And it was one of his son's greatest mistakes, Solomon.
Exactly. And then he didn't teach Solomon any positive example. Solomon took it to the extreme, right? 1,000 was the number. And that's what led Solomon away from the Lord. So, this is a real issue. And we just have to accept the fact that David did this and it was not right.
Jesus told the Pharisees that Moses allowed divorce.
Right.
Anyway, because the heart was different.
Yeah. Yeah, there were some allowances made, not because it was God's will, but because we get hard hearts, right? Because people get hard hearts. And so that, yeah, we talked about that last week, the whole idea of, you know, God has a plan for marriage that is much different than what we culturally accept. And it's because we are hard-hearted. We have trouble sometimes living with each other. So, all right, let's move on from that. We've got lots more to look at, but that's kind of, just wanted to get that glimpse. That's really just the introductory stuff to the chapter. Now we're going to get into the reason I'm calling this the rise and fall of Abner, because we're going to read, the rest of the chapter is going to be all about some things involving Abner. If you were with us last week, or if you've read before, Abner was the Saul's chief commander. He was the commander of his army and went about with Saul to all the battles. After Saul died, Abner was the one we read last week who made Saul's son Ish-bosheth king over Israel. Right. So now we're going to read an uncomfortable conversation between Abner and Ish-bosheth. So verse 6 through 11. Who can read that for me? 6 through 11. Jack?
During the war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner had been strengthening his own position in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine named Rizpah, daughter of Ahab. Ish-bosheth said to Abner, "Why did you sleep with my father's concubine?" Abner was very angry because of what Ish-bosheth said when he answered, "Am I a dog's head on Judah's side? This very day I am loyal to the house of your father Saul, to his family and friends. I haven't handed you over to David, yet now you accuse me of an offense involving this woman. May God deal with that, or be it ever so severely. If I do not do for David what the Lord promised him on an oath, and transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and establish David's throne over Israel and Judah from Dan to Beersheba." Ish-bosheth said, "Did not dare to say another word back because you were afraid of him."
Okay. All right, so what's happened here? What's Abner done? What's that?
Blackmailing?
Blackmailing? I don't know. Maybe, yeah. Accusing is an accusation.
He was called out for the sin he was committing.
He committed a sin. He went in and had sexual relation with Rizpah. Now, Rizpah was one of Saul's concubines. So again, the problem of kings and all the women that they have, in addition to having ones they called wives, and there were also some called concubines, which sometimes might be referred to as a kind of a wife. It was kind of interesting, or more maybe just almost like a female slave specifically there, you know, for sexual reasons. I don't know. It's not a good concept anyway. Chris?
Is it clear that he actually did, or was he just accused of it?
Well, he doesn't own up to it, does he?
No.
But he uses a classic, deferment, in which he does not answer the accusation, but instead he attacks with anger. Okay? Oftentimes when people attack with anger, it's usually because they don't want to answer the accusation. So we don't know for certain. We're not told exactly if he did this thing. I'm inclined to think that he did. If he did do it, what would that make you think of Abner? What's going on here between Abner and Ish-bosheth the fact that he's going in. Because this concubine, again, according to the culture, would have been inherited, I guess, by Ishbosheth. Should have belonged to him. And yet here's Abner having a relationship with her. So what's going on then?
Abner's acting like he's the king.
It's a power play a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and remember, Abner is the one from chapter 2 who put Ishbosheth in place as the king, okay? And it's telling us, is it not, that Abner is growing stronger in the house of Saul? So, again, it doesn't say exactly if he did it, but we have evidence from the conversation that Abner is clearly the strong one in this relationship.
Okay? That's the same thing that Reuben did. And then Reuben was taken down from firstborn inheritance, and Judah eventually was taken down.
Exactly. So it's kind of a power play. It's like, hey, I'm gonna flex my muscles here. I'm going to be the rooster now in the hen heart. Hen house. Chicken yard, I don't know. I'm not going to be the fox, just the rooster. So we talked about how Abner dealt with the accusation. He doesn't answer the charge. He attacks. He says, I can't believe you've accused me. And then in the ESV, it says, you accuse me of a fault concerning a woman, is the way the ESV phrases it. What does it say, skipping down here, what's the prevailing attitude about women that we're seeing so far in this chapter? You don't see any concern for the woman herself, right? That she's being kind of just toyed with as a pawn in their little game. Nor do we see David being all that concerned. I mean, can't possibly love the six wives like when you're supposed to love each other, husband and wife, right? We're seeing this attitude about, and it's unfortunate, and you might say, well, that's the attitude of that day. But there are still attitudes today where men of power, isn't that what we've been seeing in the news, where all these people have been called out because of the way they treated women, because they were men of power? And you're seeing that happen here. And that's happened in our lifetimes as well.
Exactly.
It's a sad thing because there's no concern for them. We're going to see Rizpah later on in 2 Samuel as well do something pretty honorable, actually. So you can go read that for yourself. That's much later on. Any other thoughts, Roger?
Well, I think from those verses we read earlier, too, it shows that the women were primarily used as a means to foster male heirs.
Yeah.
And so they were used for that purpose. I mean, that's what you can see from the text.
Right.
Have a male because that's where the power is.
Exactly. The more sons you had, you've got more power because, you know, you can expand your territory, all that kind of good stuff. Yeah.
Ryan?
Mm-hmm.
In that day, too, it was the fact that I think men are just naturally stronger. And it took a strong man that we've seen David, what they said about him. In his fights, he not only is strong politically, he's strong physically.
Yes. Yeah, they were choosing kings who could win battles, who could win fights.
Right.
Saul was taller than everyone else, right? He was a big guy. Abner is probably a big guy, you know, big, strong guy. And we know David, you know, had the ability, we've seen his ability to fight, not only people but animals as well.
Well, the 50 men he had, you study more of it, you see how strong each one of those guys were.
Right.
The people they killed, because they were stronger.
Yeah. And we'll see that as we read further down. Bob?
Well, Abner, I see him. He was just a manipulator.
Yes.
He took advantage of people and to his position, and it was all about him getting what he wanted.
Okay. He says something interesting here. So he resolves, as a result of this encounter, well, it appears to be a result of this encounter, he says, you know what? I'm done with you. I'm going to give the kingdom to David. All right? What does he say as part of that? That is extremely interesting. He refers to what the Lord had promised David. What does Abner then thus reveal about himself?
He knows that David's supposed to have it.
He knew it before he took Ish-bosheth and made him king, right? He knew that David was the one that the Lord had said was going to be king. So you have to ask yourself the question, well then, what's he all about? Not about doing the Lord's will. He's about his own power. It made sense to him in chapter 2 to make Ish-bosheth king because then he could be powerful in Israel. He thought that that's what would be his path to glory, so to speak. Maybe he eventually thought he would be king. Maybe this situation with the concubine was him saying, I'm going to be king now. It's interesting. Remember last week we read that Ish-bosheth only served for 2 years as king, but yet David was king at Hebron for 6.5 years. So what's going on the other 4.5 years? Is it essentially Abner in charge in Israel during that time?
Yeah.
I mean, we're kind of seeing him, and then once he sees that the power is waning, and maybe because the Philistines are threatening, and they no longer have a strong army because a lot of them have been killed, maybe he's now thinking, it's now time for me to join David. That's my path to success.
I think another scripture, the last one we read there, the Lord said verse 11, Ishmael said, did not dare to say another word to Abner because you were afraid of
him. Right. You can clearly see Ish-bosheth is just a figurehead in that. He has no power.
Right? A lot of self-preservation. You know what I mean?
Yes.
When another king takes over, that means that next guy in charge, they get off, you know, or disappear.
Yeah.
So he's trying to make himself relevant and safe.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe that's the reason why he, even though he knew what the Lord's will was, maybe thought to himself, if I let David become king, I'll be on the outs. I might even get killed. Yeah. So, for whatever reason, Abner is basically just looking out for Mr. Abner. All right, let's keep reading. Let's read verses 12 through 16 now. Who's got that for me? Keith? All right.
Then Abner sent messengers on his behalf to say to David, whose land is it? Make an agreement with me, and I will help you bring all Israel over to you. Good, said David. I will bring an agreement with you, but I demand one thing of you. Do not come into my presence unless you bring Michelle, daughter of Saul, when you come to see me. Then David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, demanding, give me my wife, Michelle, whom I betroth to myself for the price of 100 Philistine foreskins. So Ish-bosheth gave orders and had her taken away from her husband, Bethel, son of Achlash. Her husband, however, went with her, weeping behind her all the way to Beth-Suri. And then Abner said to him, go back home. So he went back.
Okay. So Abner is going to make good on his vow. He contacts David. He sends him a text, calls him, whatever. Sends messengers to him, it says. And says, hey, I think it's time that we make a covenant. David says, okay. You know, David's not dumb. He says, okay. But I want you to do this. What does he want him to do?
Bring his wife, that first wife.
Bring his first wife. Yeah. Saul's daughter, Michal, wants to bring her back. Hold your finger here. Go back to 1 Samuel 18. Let's do a real quick kind of remembrance of their relationship, how that whole thing started. 1 Samuel 18. At first, Saul talked about giving his older daughter to David, but then he didn't do it. But then in verse 20 of 1 Samuel 18, it says, "Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him." All right, so she sees David. She's in love with him. All right? So it starts out good. It seems like they started out with a good, loving relationship, or at least there's love on her side. Saul, of course, sees it as, because he's already jealous of David, he sees it as an opportunity maybe to get rid of David. He says, let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. And so he comes and he says, "You're going to be my son-in-law, and the bride price will be 100 Philistine foreskins." We won't talk too much about that. That's not very pleasant. But David goes out and kills 200 Philistines. He pays double what Saul had asked for. And then it says down in verse 27 that Saul gave him his daughter Michal for a wife. And when Saul saw that and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, his daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So that's kind of the situation, but you know, not a good father-in-law situation there. Now, if you go down to verse 19, Saul's still trying to kill, or chapter 19, verse 11, Saul's still trying to kill David. He sends messengers to his house, but Michal, David's wife, told David, "If you do not escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So Michal let David down through the window. He fled away and escaped. She took an image, laid it on the bed, put a pillow of goat's hair in its head. And so basically, she helps David escape. And even Saul says, "Why did you deceive me?" You know. And then she says, "Well, he said he was going to kill me." You know. So she is committed, it seems to be, to David's to David and his safety. All right. Then if you go to chapter 25, verse 44, we're told, it's just reporting, Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Galim. So that kind of brings us up to the situation. So at some point, David on the run, he marries his other two women. Saul gives Michal to another man, and they are married. I don't know if there's a bigamy situation here, whether there was a divorce decree. He, being the king, probably could do that, and it was considered legal to him. That brings us up to what's happening in this chapter. So, why do you think Ishbosheth complies with David's request for Michal?
I wasn't going to answer that question. I had a comment on what we were just looking at.
Yes.
If you go to Deuteronomy 24:4, when it's talking about divorce, if a woman is married and she is divorced and is given to another man and marries him, she cannot go back to her first husband.
Yeah.
So you've got a messy situation here, because that will defile the land. That's
right.
An abomination to the Lord. And so that's what you have in this situation.
Yeah, and so once again we see David, he's violating God's law, isn't he?
Yeah.
He doesn't
have a right to take her back.
Why does he want her back?
Pride.
It's pride, yeah.
A power play.
And it's a power play. Is it because he loves her? Could be, but it doesn't say anything about that. And from what we're seeing, I don't know. I mean, we just can't say exactly, but that doesn't appear to be, at least at first blush, that doesn't appear to be the motivation here, right?
Maybe he would, if he really loved her, maybe 7 years ago, he would first thing, when he got to be the king of Judah, he'd been like, "The first thing I'm going to do is get my wife back.
I'm going to get my wife, no matter what it costs," yeah. I mean, you know, if he truly loved her, he would have found a way to get to her. You know, that's what we see in Hollywood anyway. And we got all sorts of people going on here.
I'm going to say that this time, he had at least six wives beyond that.
So certainly the relationship's not going to be the same.
No.
Gary?
I don't know. The way you read this in the Bible times here, I don't know that men loved women at all. They were objects to be gained and given for power plays. And of course, I know that there's a lot of them do love their wives and stuff. So
right.
You see that. But in this case, I think David just gave McCall just out of the power play.
Just out of power.
And then he turned around and used her as leverage.
Are we seeing any example in this chapter of a man who loves his wife?
Yes.
Paltiel, right? He's following after her, weeping.
He definitely did love her.
Whatever her relationship with David was before, it appears that she has a great marriage relationship with Paltiel. I mean, if he's following after her weeping, he loved her. And I don't think that she was not loving him back. I think that was a strong marriage situation that got busted up by David's desire for a power play. And you've got Ish-bosheth, who by this time has become so weak. I mean, this is his enemy. He's basically kind of saying, I know you've won, David. Here's your wife. And you've got Abner in the mix, too. So David told Abner, hey, make sure she comes back. I'm going to send to her from Ish-bosheth. And here comes Abner, who Ish-bosheth fears. And he says, I'm ready to take Michal back. And his power is so great that all he has to do is tell Paltiel, get out of here. And then he has to return.
That's a great problem with power, is that morality or morals really drops to the bottom.
Exactly.
And you sure see that here.
Yeah.
And David, he should not have done that.
Yeah, no. This was a problem on his part. Bob, you had something? And then over here.
Well, it kind of reads like a soap opera, actually.
It does.
And they're all using what power they have to further their own agenda.
They are, yeah.
They think they're getting away with something, but they're never down the road. David's going to pay the cost.
Yeah, there will be consequences for these actions.
Just like that.
And that's true for us as well. Just because we see it reported here and we don't see any negative comments being made, that doesn't mean that these are not wrong things. All right, let's keep going so we've got some more to cover here. Flip your paper over. Look at verse 17. This is in 2 Samuel 3. I'll just read this real quick. Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, for some time past you've been seeking David as king over you. Now then bring it about, for the Lord has promised David, saying, by the hand of my servant David I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies. Abner also spoke to Benjamin, and then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. Okay, so you can see he's putting together a political alliance. You know, he's, again, more of a power thing. He's talking to all the key leaders and saying, hey, you guys, you know you want David to be king. Now's the time. I'm putting together a coalition. We're going to get it done. Right? He's putting together his majority in parliament. If you know how parliament works, you have to have a majority to rule. So... So that's what he's doing, right? He's making good on his promise. It's interesting, he mentions the Philistines, because I think that part of the problem, the fear that he has, is that the Philistines have continued to be strong and oppressive against them, and his armies have become weaker and weaker, and he needs the strength of David to deal with that problem, too. All right, let's keep moving now. The next section, two old rivals. So let's read verses 20 through 25. Let's see, who can do that for me?
But Abner, who had 20 men with him, came to David the Hebron David prepared a feast for him and his men. Then Abner said to David, let me go at once and assemble all Israel for my lord the king, so that they may make a compact with you, and that you may rule over all your heart's desire. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Just then David's men and Joab returned from a raid and brought with them a great deal of plunder. But Abner was no longer with David in Hebron, because David had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the soldiers heard him arrive, he was told that Abner's son, Ner, had come to the king, and that the king had sent him away, and that he had gone in peace. So Joab went to the king and said, what have you done? Look, Abner. Look, Abner came to you. Why did you let him go? Now he is gone. You know Abner, the son of Ner. He came to you to deceive you and observe your movements and find out everything you are doing.
Okay. So, what's good about this meeting?
What about peace?
It's a chance for peace, isn't it? It's a chance for a peaceful end to the conflict. Peaceful union of the kingdoms. All right? That's positive. So, you know, I think David recognizes that. So, okay, yeah, I'll meet with you, Abner. Yeah, let's do that. Any problems? What do you see as a problem with how this meeting is arranged?
Abner brought 20 men with him. Apparently, was a little afraid to come there, wasn't he? Bodyguard?
Yeah, it could be bodyguards. Could be some of the other leaders of the tribes. If so, that would be like a delegation that's kind of affirming that they're all together in doing this. Doesn't say that the men, we don't know, they might have been guards. You know, when you travel in those times is dangerous, you might want to have a group with you. So. Some harshness there. Now, where's Joab? He's out making a raid. It doesn't appear that he had any foreknowledge that this meeting was going to take place. So you've got, remember, you had David and Ishbosheth, the kings. You had Abner, the general, and David's general was Joab. So, I think David's made an error here. Maybe he did it on purpose, but he left Joab out of the conversation. And you see Joab's response afterwards is not good, right? He's distressed about what's happened here. He says, the reason he gives is he feels like Abner's just coming to spy on you, David, and to figure out what you're doing. You know, but there's a problem here that Joab was left out of this. And there's a couple of reasons why. One, you know, Joab had a rightful place at that table as one of the key figures in David's administration, right? He needed to be there, and there was already bad blood between them, so David should have done some advance. Hey, you know, I know you've had issues with Abner. We have an opportunity to resolve this. Can you help me do that? If he had taken that approach, I think Joab would have said, okay, for your sake, David, I will. But he left him out of it. And Joab is probably, one, either fearing that he's about to lose a job to Abner, right? But also, he has a grudge against Abner. Abner killed his brother. So, I think there's a flaw there in the way that David did that. Alright, we've got to finish reading the chapter. We've just got a few minutes left here. Verse 26, look at that. All right, so Joab says, I can't believe you did this, David. And then it says, when Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah, but David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. Afterward, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house, and may the house of Joab never be... This is a great curse, by the way. May the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge, or who is leprous, or who holds a spindle, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David followed the bier. They buried Abner at Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented for Abner, saying, should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen. And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day. But David swore, saying, God do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner the son of Ner. The king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. Well, there's a lot there that we got to cover in less than a minute. All right. Is Joab justified in killing Abner? Yes or no?
No.
In his mind, yes. He feels like he's being an avenger of blood. We're not going to go back there, but if you read Numbers 35, there was in the law an allowance that if a murderer, somebody murdered somebody, a close relative could be the avenger and could take their life for the life of the one that was murdered. That was usually in a murder situation. Remember, Joab's brother died in a war situation, and it's different in a war situation. Yeah, I mean, Joab hated him, and he wanted him dead because he killed his brother. The irony is, also as part of that old law, there were six cities of refuge in which someone who had committed a manslaughter could flee to that city and be safe from the avenger until such time as a trial could happen. All right? So that sounded good. Guess what? Hebron is one of those cities. He killed him in the gate of a city of refuge. So we've got issues now with Joab too, right? He's doing his own thing. He's motivated by revenge, and his motivation causes him to do things that are not in anybody's best interest, because this sets back the process of uniting the kingdom, doesn't it? They missed a chance here to finish the war and to unite things, because he killed the man who was trying to get it done. As we finish up, what can we say about the Lord's will and choices that we've seen people make in this chapter? How does it all work together? Because it is the Lord's will for the David to have the kingdom, right?
All these meetings they had earlier, all this stuff, they never mentioned the specific God, the guidance and the strength, right?
Yeah, calling upon God for guidance is left out of this chapter, isn't it?
Yeah.
Doing it their way instead of God.
Yeah. Yeah. They were bringing things about the way they thought was right.
Just like
that,
David made a pretty good show, so he took advantage of the opportunity to make himself look really good.
Yes.
To go ahead and unite everybody.
And again, there's a political thing going on there. He wants all of Israel to know that he did not order Abner's death, that he was not involved, because he needs to have the support of all of Israel if he's going to be their king. Yeah.
I think he's glad.
Might have been glad, right?
Just a side note here. You can't have two commanders working at the same ship like that in Montgomery in World War II. But David should have clarified that with him. He is standing and letting things happen and reacting rather than being under, and he could resolve some of these issues here.
Yeah, like we said earlier, David could have led better and prevented, I think, this from happening. Or could have maybe at least had more of a fair resolution of the conflict between Joab and Abner. Right? He could have led the situation better, and he didn't. He kind of let it happen. In fact, at the end there, he's saying, I'm gentle. Some versions say they use the word weak. He was unable to do... I mean, he doesn't punish Joab. I think because he knows he needs him, but also because he fears him.
I think that's the besetting sin of David, because we see that later with his family. He always reacts too late.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really take charge of himself. And he has family problems that are going on because of that.
Yeah. And so here's the thing to keep in mind, because as we said at the beginning, you know, David is described as the man after God's own heart. That doesn't mean that he is perfect in all of the things that he does. He's still a man with flaws, just like all of us. It's just proof again that we all need righteousness from God and not our own righteousness.
He shows the insecurities of the men.
Exactly.
They had the problem, somebody had a problem, but they didn't kill him.
Yeah. Yeah.
The scriptures say there's a way to see Christ, a man, and destruction.
Exactly. Yeah, and we see that happening. That's what this chapter is all about, right? The way that seemed right to man was not the right way. All right, thank you all very much. We'll see you next time.